Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Now is the Time. Marla, you're there, aren't you?
I'm here.
How are you?
I'm excited to meet our guest.
Yes, I am very excited, too. So we are. This is a real exciting thing. We're interviewing Marcus Luttrell on Monday, and we're actually replaying this on Tuesday night on Now is the Time. We want to tell all of our friends about it. And Marcus Luttrell is joining us today, and we're really honored to have him here. He's a Navy SEAL, and we're going to talk about the Navy SEALs. And he's just written an incredible book about the Navy SEALs and his experience in the mountains of Afghanistan in late spring, early summer of 2005. His best-selling book, which is published by Little Brown, is entitled Lone Survivor. Marcus, how are you today?
I'm good, sir. Thank you.
Good. Very good. So once again, thank you for joining us, and this is an honor. It's very rare that I personally get to meet a true American hero, and you are a true American hero, and of course awarded with the Purple Medal by the President.
The Purple Heart, yes, sir. So, but I really don't like that title. So, Marcus is fine.
You're very humble, Marcus, but we're going to brag on you, and thank you for your service to our country. We appreciate
it's my pleasure.
So the book is incredible, and I really recommend that everyone, you know, go pick it up. And you know, as we're going to spend some time talking about it today with Marcus and Marla, the story is fascinating. So why don't we get into it first? About what is a Navy? Can you describe what a Navy SEAL is?
Well, the best way to describe it, sir, is Navy SEAL stands for Sea, Air, and Land Specialist. So pretty much anywhere that somebody, the enemy goes from anywhere on the planet, well, we can get to them, irregardless of the terrain or anything that dictates our movement. So, we're the Special Forces group of the Navy.
Now, Marla, you had said you'd met some senior people from Special Forces, right?
I got to meet Lieutenant General Wagner. In 2005, I went to Fort Bragg to be the entertainment. Can you imagine that? Me being entertainment for the volunteers for Special Forces, the people, the husbands and wives that volunteer to keep all the families involved in, you know, when their loved ones are out. And there was 200 people there, and I sat at the table with General Wagner, and he stole my microphone. So I got to meet all the commanders. It was very secure. I felt really good that day, having all these guys in uniform around me, and it was an honor to be there to talk to them about what they do and how I'm trying to keep the home fires burning while the guys and gals are serving our country.
In the book, the book breaks down into, the way I see it, in two sections. One is what goes into becoming a Navy SEAL and a lot of the training, really a third, and also your home and your twin brother, your brother 7 minutes older, I think. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
7 minutes. He's the old one in the family, and you've always strived you've always lived with that, right?
Yes, sir. No, there's no debating that.
Right, 7 minutes, and he's also a Navy SEAL, correct?
Yes, sir.
And then you talk about Navy SEALs, and I want to talk a little about that, because some of your description's fascinating, and I didn't know much about it, but I really learned an incredible amount from that. And then we get into what happened in Afghanistan and that surreal story. So, but first, with regard to the training, I mean, talk a little about the training to become a Navy SEAL. You talk about, you know, taking showers with wet, like ice-cold jets. Just what is it like? I mean, just, you know, for the average person to kind of understand what you go through.
That's actually one of the toughest things to describe. I mean, even in the book, I didn't really give it justice. You try and tell somebody what buzz training is like. It's just, and people can read about it and do whatever they want, and they think they can train for it, but the only way to really experience this is to go through it. I use the analogy to people that, you know, and in everyday life, people go to a movie, and that was, you know, it was a horrible movie, or or had a hard day because you know, it rained, I got stuck in traffic, and you know, my boss yelled at me or something like that. That day sucks for them. You know, our definition is totally different of a bad day than the normal human being. So our day starts first thing in the morning, probably 2-3 o'clock, and usually you went to bed about 2 hours ago. And I used to just walk outside, and the clothes that I wore the day before, they were already wet and sandy. I just put them back on because you know that you're going to get back into the ocean, and that's how you start your day. You start every day in the water, and then roll in the sand, and then you're off. So, you know, as far as, and a lot of people are just like, there's no way I could possibly do that, and I'm like, yes, you can. I give people advice on how to get through budge training. They're like, hey, Marcus, I want to be a SEAL. I'm like, hey, look, you go in there and you take it. Don't take it week by week or day by day or hour by hour. Take it evolution by evolution, however long that lasts. You know, whatever it is you're doing at that moment, just think to yourself, there's nothing anybody can do to make me quit. They're going to have to kill me to get me out of here. And just really basically check the life that you live right now at the door. Nothing else should matter. Because if the second you start thinking about anything on the outside world, like a girlfriend or a wife or whatever it is, then you're going to miss something, and you're going to find yourself with your helmet underneath the bell, and you're not going to be in SEAL training anymore. And that's the way it usually happens.
You have to stay focused.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, that's the thing. That's the whole premise behind budge training, is they break you down to the bottom level. They take everything away from you. I mean, and then they start building you back up.
That's for your protection, though.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, it's funny because when people come in, they're like, this training is inhumane. You can't do this to the guys. They, you know, what they're doing is they're getting us ready to go over and fight in combat. I mean, this isn't a knitting class. You know, this is serious. And if I wouldn't have went through the training that I went through, and as hard as it was, there's no way I would have lived.
Well,
and
I don't know how you lived anyway.
That mountain that day because of what I went through in my training.
Yeah, no, it's apparent that clearly, you know, helped you. I mean, I still don't know how you made it through. So you talked a lot about the SEAL. So let's kind of describe now where you went, and let's get into the story of what happened in Afghanistan. Where did it take place in Afghanistan? What were you there for to do?
For Red Wing?
Yes, for Red Wing.
I was in Afghanistan. It was right on the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan in a mountain range called the Hindu Kush Mountain Range, and in a province inside there, inside the mountain range itself was Konar. And our purpose was, we were a special reconnaissance team, sniper team, to go. We were sent in to capture or kill a guy with known ties to Osama bin Laden. He's a high-ranking individual. And we went in for 3 and 4 days to monitor his movement and gain intelligence and radio, send that back to the guys in the rear. And then if we got the green light to go on in, we'd either take him out or we'd go in and snatch and grab.
And this was Ben Sharmack, correct?
That's not his real name.
Oh, it isn't?
That's the
okay.
name I use in the book. I wouldn't give him, you know, there's no way I was going to write his name in a book. I wouldn't give that guy the time of day, so.
Okay. Well, fine, good. So this Afghan leader who was close to Osama bin Laden had assembled a force of, you had said, somewhere between 80 and 200, right? So you put it more around, you kind of split the difference and said around 140?
Right. Yes, sir. The intelligence that we gathered and that was given to us through our brief before we went out was that this is how many guys he had. Their group was known as the Mountain Tigers. So, I mean, they were, and they, you know, they invited any kind of American force into their area and just like, come on, you know, bring it on. We'll take on anybody. And I mean, that was their backyard, so that's what we were tasked to do.
And you went in with yourself and three other SEALs. And can you name them?
Yeah, well, Danny Dietz, Michael Murphy, and Matt Axelson.
So four of you went into a mountainous terrain in a foreign land against mountain tigers, and there were 140 of them there. And so we're talking about odds of around 35 to 1. So
yes,
that to me, again, I mean, if you think about this, you know, our listeners, think about those odds and what went through your mind when you flew over there.
Well, no, I was excited. I mean, we were ready to do it. It was our job. that's what we train for. I mean, the worse the odds for us, the better in our mind. You know, it's kind of like you should see it sometimes. It's kind of comical because guys, they're like, okay, we got, you know, we only have 10 guys out, you know, 10 bad guys out there shooting at us, and then we're going in with a whole platoon. Everybody gets kind of upset because, you know, those odds aren't against us; they're for us. So when we go up against somebody, you know, insurmountable odds, it's just kind of one of those things where everybody gets kind of fired up and let's do it, let's get it on.
And
I know it's a sick way of thinking, but it's kind of like
hey, it takes a different breed to be in reconnaissance.
Right, I mean, they just kind of beat that into our head. It's just the way we're trained.
It's just a remarkable thing. Well, so let's carry on. So you're there now. You get dropped in this area, which was not the easiest thing to do also, and you've gotten the gear and the night goggles, and you're pretty well equipped for what you're about to encounter. And then you run into, you're sitting on this cliff or this area where you seem pretty comfortable with your environment, and then you run into some goat herders come in and see you, and they run into you actually. Can you talk about that?
Sure, we had set up over our target objective of monitoring our area, and then just like you said, some goat herders had walked up on the side of the cliff we were on and over the top of us, literally over the top of me, and dropped down in front of me. I stood up real fast and grabbed this guy and pulled him over and started interrogating him, and then two other guys walked up, started interrogating them, and they weren't giving up any information or anything like that. However, they weren't brandishing any firearms or, you know, there wasn't any kind of aggression from them towards us. But when we were asking them questions and trying to interrogate them, they weren't giving us any information whatsoever. And I tell people, I'm just like, look, when someone looks at you like they hate you, that's totally different than when somebody looks at you like they want to kill you or they just can't stand the sight of you. And that's kind of the look we were getting from these people, so...
So there was a dilemma, though, at that point, right? You had a dilemma.
Right. I mean, what we were going to do with them. We were in the middle of nowhere and trying to recon this area. And obviously, we couldn't keep them with us. And that's about how fast it went. You know, we were just kind of sitting there talking, me and the OIC. I'm just like, hey, you know, what do you want to do these guys? Like, if you want to kill them, you know, we got to execute these guys. And all the mountains of Afghanistan, they had to walk up on the one that we were on. So we talked about it, and we're like, you know, if we kill these guys, somehow, some way, it'll work its way back to us, and we're going to have to, you know, face the system. I was like, well, we can tie them up. If we tie them up, we're going to die. And they had like 100 goats, 75 to 100 goats scattered everywhere. Like, if we tie them up, they'll die anyways. And our only alternative was to turn them loose. So that's what we did, turn them loose.
You didn't have rope, though, right? And you said, because I would wonder that as I read the book, why didn't you just tie them up and just bound them and, you know, because you were afraid of the repercussions of that?
No, we have stuff to subdue, you know, our target. So we had all that, but it's just if we did, what are we going to do with them? We got to leave them right there. We can't take them with us. There's four of us and three of them. You know, and there was no area to hide. You know, we barely had a place to get cover. So just, if we left them there, they would end up dead anyways.
So this is really the first time you talk about liberal media. You use the term you don't even just say media, you say liberal media throughout the book. Is that, what do you just, do you want to talk a little about that?
Well, I mean, what do you want to know?
Well, in the sense that you say that we're going to, you're afraid that you're thinking about the decision and that the liberal media, that if you kill them, which you seem to feel was the right move militarily, I guess after the fact, that's another question I have for you. Was it the right? Was killing them the right decision from a military standpoint?
Well, I mean, you read the book, All My Friends Are Dead. I knew exactly what was going to happen. They brought back all those guys. We got in a gunfight and died, which is part of our job. I'll never second-guess the decision I made out there. But, I mean, in my opinion, I don't think the media has any business being in my business. I mean, you guys are good at what you do. You report, you know, the news or everything. But if you're out there starting to monitor what I do in a war environment, then with a camera and a radio and it's not just that, it's just people trying to implement rules of engagement when they're sitting back here in a leather chair and they have no idea what's going on over there because the enemy doesn't follow any rules. So basically I'm walking out there with one hand cuffed to my leg, you know, trying to fight and maybe not even have a rifle.
Because
sometimes you're not, I mean, the rules of engagement to even engage a target is so, you know, ridiculous that just kind of blows you away. I mean, they're just why are you even sending, you know, if you're not going to let me do my job, why send me over there? And
right,
that's kind of the stuff that we're facing over there. It's really frustrating.
Right. I mean, just to clarify, we're on Blog Talk Radio. This is a platform I created, which is, we call it the Citizen Broadcast Network. We're not affiliated with any media company. Marla and I are individuals, and we have this media platform that we created that we've produced about 90,000 broadcasts in the last 15 months. Much of what conversations taking place like this. So we're not the media, and as you would note that. So I guess you let them go, and they obviously told the leader and their organization, you know, and the soldiers that you guys were there. So what happens next?
We turn them loose, and then we relocated, and then about 45 minutes later, the militia showed up on top of us.
And I guess you have no place to go but what, down, right?
Yes, sir, down. They came straight over the top of us and down our side, down our flanks, both right and left flank. So the only place we had to go down, was down. Yes, sir.
Now what's down? I mean, it's not a little ledge, correct? I mean, you're on the side of a cliff.
Yeah, we were at 9,500 feet, and then, yeah, we were right off the edge of the cliff, and the only place to go was straight down the mountain, into the village. We were actually into our target objective.
So you just decide there, okay, guys, it's time. We're either going to die here or we're going to jump.
And there's
jump
no
out.
Cover, Marcus. Is it desert? Are there any trees? There's 90 trees above 9,000 feet.
Well, yes, ma'am, there was. Actually,
there were
trees that were growing up the side of the mountain, and that's where we were hiding. We were positioned in there. And then once the gunfight ensued, they pushed us out of there. Because normally in a situation when you were getting ambushed, you'd rush the ambush, but it was so steep up the mountain that we couldn't. I mean, we were on our hands and knees. We couldn't even fire our weapons. So the only place we had to go, and same with the right and left flank. So the only place we had to go was down. And once we came out of that tree line and it opened up, just to answer your question, ma'am, is yes, it opened up, and we didn't have any cover because they had pushed us down into like a funnel, a draw area, and they were on the high ground above us, 150 to 200 meters. So like, you know, like shooting fish in a barrel, kind of.
Yeah, they're just in that draw, and you coming right at you, and you're just going. You've got gravity on your side. That's the only thing that was on your side is gravity.
That's it, just gravity. Yes, ma'am.
So you go down there now and. You're fighting. I mean, as soon as you land, you're getting shot at from all over the place. It's amazing that you didn't get shot at this time. How did the others?
No, that's not really the case, sir. We were getting shot at pretty bad.
No, but you personally didn't get hit with a bullet at that.
No, I didn't get hit till further down the mountain.
Right, right. But you were getting shot at pretty bad, and some of your and the other people you were with, right? Danny and then Axe and Murphy, they got hit at different times during this battle that seemed to go on for how long when you first got confronted in that ambush to when you then met the people, the Afghan leaders who then protected you?
Over a day and a half, maybe?
A day and a half. And...
Yes,
now the Afghan the people that you were fighting against seem to be very well trained. Is that right? Is that typical in Afghanistan the way they're fighting this war there?
Well, it just kind of depends on who you go up against and where you find them at. But there's a lot of guys out there that are pretty good. You know, they're pretty well trained, pretty good at what they do. Yes, sir.
One of the things that you talk a lot about faith in the book, and I think the point that really hits home is about the rifle. Can you talk about, you know, that and how that rifle stuck by your side the whole time and how you can explain it?
Well, I can't explain it, really. But I just, you know, tumbling down that mountain, I mean, we tumbled halfway down it, and then the next day, I mean, all through the night, I must have stepped off the mountain two or three times and fell hundreds of feet. And every time I turn around, you know, a rifle would be laying right next to me. I just couldn't throw the thing away. Somehow, some way, it always managed to get back to me.
Your strap, it fell on the first fall down the mountain. Isn't correct that the strap fell off?
Right, yep, my strap broke, yes, sir. my lanyard that kept it snug to my body, it busted. And while I was tumbling down, I looked up and it was sticking in a rock. The barrel had plugged into a rock.
Did you have to clean the
gun it on the way down.
Before you could use
Ma'am?
It? Did you have to clean the gun before you could use it? Or just
well,
get
it wasn't,
the dirt
it
out?
Wasn't a dirt area. It was rock.
Rock.
And trees.
So it was wedged.
So, yes, ma'am. It was wedged in there.
So when we talk about...
I mean,
when you talk about
don't get me wrong. My rifle took a beating. I mean,
they're
so,
made to do that.
Yeah, I'm like, right. So...
But just so everyone gets a clear picture of this, you're on a cliff. You're now ambushed by hundreds more than a hundred, you know, Afghan Taliban terrorists. You fall off. You jump off this cliff. I don't know, 1,000 feet. At one point,
oh,
on
no,
one
we
of these
fell
jumps.
About five. We fought about 5,000 feet down a mountain.
5,000 feet down a mountain. What was the incline?
Like a double black diamond.
Okay.
For those of you who ski. I mean, and then it'd level out in some areas, but the only reason that would happen is because it was boulders and trees. So, but if we take 5 to 10 steps, you know, you'd have to jump at least 10 to 15 feet down or wedge your way across the canyon.
Wow, that's quite an incline. That's just...
Well, it was one of those things. If you were trying to run that, it was like a fall. I mean, it was... controlled chaos. The only time you could ever stop and get your position is once you fell off the rock and landed on the ground. And just, yes, ma'am, it was impossible.
How did your faith
sustain
you?
I mean, the initial 200 yards, we just tumbled down the mountain.
How did your faith...
I mean, there wasn't any shooting involved at all, just tumbling down the mountain.
Just getting away and the gravity taking you, protecting you.
Right. I mean, we wanted to hold and fight, but you just couldn't stop yourself from falling. Ground can't come out from underneath us.
You must have had a lot of angels around you that day. That's all I can say. Or you wouldn't be here right now and that rifle being beside you. Your faith must hold you pretty tight. Did that help you
any
that day?
Of course. I mean, I try to tell people, like, people pray every day at dinner and before they go to bed, but there's just certain times and certain situations in your life that you know when you're talking to God and he's listening. Because I was screaming, boy.
What were you saying? Okay, God, now it's your turn to take care of me.
Right. You know, my friends were dying, so I just kind of went out. Well, there's multiple times I was by myself, you know, and I was just like, you know,
how long did the fight, going down the mountain, the 5,000 feet, how long did that last, in hours or?
2 hours, hours.
Hours.
But,
yes, ma'am.
But, you know, you would land, get into battles, move on, fall off another cliff.
Yes, sir.
We
landed into a formation of rocks. That's when we set up. We kind of separated throughout the mountain. That way guys could shoot and other guys could. The only place we could get to was down. The whole idea, sir, was to get to that village we were watching because it was flat down there, or flatter. And we thought once we got there, we would be good to go. We just ran out of ammo and you know, guys just were bleeding to death.
Well, and you talk about, you know, in the heroic acts of the other SEALs that didn't make it, and I reading it, just Danny in particular, how, you know, he got his hand blown off, or thumb blown off, and notwithstanding that, he's bleeding from everywhere. I mean, it just, you know, the way you write it and how you approach it, just like, you know, it blew me away. But as he's got no thumb and he's shooting and he's dying and he's just fighting and getting more and more rounds done. I mean, what, describe that.
I mean, that's just the way he was made. I mean, he's gonna keep fighting until you take that last breath. I mean, he wasn't going to give up on the rest of us just because he was shot up.
Well, I have to say, in, you know, reading many books, I mean, the way you approached it in this book, it just gives it puts you right there, and you got into his mind and your mind.
Marcus, I'm an author,
yes, ma'am,
too, and I've had a New York Times bestseller. What possessed you to write this? most heroes keep their story to themselves, and maybe they'll tell their grandchildren in 50 years. What made you decide to write your story and the story of your friends?
Well, the only reason I did it, the main reason I did it, is I was in the hospital, and somebody came up to me, and they were like, "Hey, look, there's a couple of guys writing a book about what happened to you guys up in the mountains in Afghanistan." And I was like, "Well, how is that possible? It's classified. Nobody knows about it." And they were just like, "Well, all the media reports and what they read on the news, and they asking questions to people who didn't really know anything." So they were basically the fabrication of what had happened up there. And you know who has to answer to the widows and the mothers and the fathers and the cousins and the aunts every time something comes out in the news? You know who has to answer those questions, right? I do.
You do.
So I get phone calls all the time from, you know, people crying, like, "Why didn't you tell me this about myself?" I'm like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." So the whole reason I did it, and the only reason I did it, was one, if you want to know what happened up there, read the book, because I'm trying to get back to work. And I just couldn't. That's it. That's the only reason.
Just read the book.
I never. This is one operation we did. I don't talk about anything else I've ever done on the teams. This is the one thing. And the only reason I did that is so no one could take, you know, disrespect or disgrace the honor of my friends on the mountain that day.
How is the Pentagon?
What happened, it's right there in black and white.
Has the military or the Pentagon responded to this book? And have you been in touch with them?
Oh, I don't do anything without them.
So they've endorsed this, and you know, because it is a true, it's a story that I think the Pentagon and military, Department of Defense would embrace, because you've just such a hero, and you did an amazing job through thick and thin. You never questioned anything.
Well, I mean, no, I mean, you know, it's not like I just sat down and I told it the way it was, and I was like, "Sir, you know, obviously I didn't." And there's a lot of stuff I had to leave out of the book that happened out there, and one went down. But it's just a true testament of what, you know, the battle we fought. And it was about the guys, and they didn't have any problem with it. Everything in that book. I mean, when I wrote it and I handed it over to the military, they read it. They didn't pull anything out of it. They were like, "Looks good to me."
Oh, you told the truth, and that's all
it.
We
and
asked.
That's why. I mean, it's just like I didn't, you know. And I get a lot of scrutiny all the time because when I open my mouth, I don't lie. I don't church anything up. I kind of speak what's on my mind and they all know that. So
that's how you grew up. That's how you were trained, and
right.
It shows.
Talk a little more now. So now you're the other SEALs have died. You're now on your own. You're confronted with. I mean, you know, it doesn't look great for you. But you run into some Afghan, you know, other Afghans that are not part of the Taliban. Explain that, and then just briefly explain this phrase, loke. Is it pronounced loke?
Yes, sir. It's a 2,000-year-old tradition that when a traveler comes in or someone comes in and asks for help, once they offer help up, then they'll fight to the death defending you or trying to save you, or feed you, or whatever it is, and that's what they did for me. I didn't know that at the time, but that's what was going on. And once the villagers got a hold of me, they kind of harbored me from the Taliban, because the Taliban had circled the village and was trying to get me out of there. So it was pretty rough.
And one of the most frightful moments of the book is when you, at one point, with the son of the leader of this village, confronted this Ben Sharmack, individual.
Right.
I just couldn't believe that, you know, they didn't just shoot you right there. And what you're saying is this loke, this 2,000-year-old set of rules saved your life at that moment?
Yes, sir.
A tradition.
That's what I'm saying.
That is.
Befriending someone that asks you for help. That's amazing.
Right, exactly. And that's kind of, you know, it's one of those things where I crawled into that village, bleeding, shot up with a Taliban on my hip, you know, trying to kill me. And these people saved my life. And they had no, I mean, I was an American, foreign man, a foreign land. I couldn't walk out of my hotel room right now and get a ride down the street. And if I was bloody and crawling down the road, no one would help me. You know what I'm saying? And that's just one of those things. I was like, this is incredible. These people, you know, gave me food and shelter and bandaged me up.
Have you spoke to them since?
No,
then?
No, sir.
No way. Okay, so there was one individual. I don't recall the name. What was the name of the individual who
There was actually the whole village itself did this. I mean, they're the ones that all stepped up. The whole village stepped up. But as far as the guy who was around me all the time was Sarawa was the one of them. He was the medic. And then Golab was the son of the village elder. And the village elder would come in and see me every now and again, but not too much. I mean, he was.
How long were you there, Marcus?
4.5 days. What it was.
Dressed in garb, and you look like you were a member of the Taliban, right?
Right. Only I'm a lot taller and a lot wider than most of those guys. So I mean, even though I wasn't dressed up like them, at night I could move around. But I mean, we had discussions like this all the time. I mean, even during the daytime, when I try to stand up, move around, then the guys they'd push me back down. They were like, you know, Taliban will kill you, because you do not look like us. I'm like, I know I don't look like you.
So what's your size, Marcus? And what was their size?
Well, they're 5'6", ranging, up to 5'9", I guess. I'm, 6'5", I was 240 pounds.
Okay. You're a big guy.
Yes, ma'am.
Big Texan. They grow them big in Texas.
So, they do. So let's talk a little about Texas. And again, we're speaking with Marcus Luttrell, and we're talking about his new book called The Lone Survivor, and you're listening to Now is the Time with Marla and Alan, and we're honored to be joined today by Marcus. What's going on in your town when it becomes aware that there are four missing soldiers, missing SEALs? What's going on at your home?
Well, once word got out that I was kind of one of the guys that was, missing, well, first off, it came out that the media told my mother I was dead. So my mom thought I was dead for about 4 days, and then it'd come across that, maybe not. Well, we don't know. He might be dead. That was the news that was coming back to my house. And then when the military and the town folk all came around and they heard about it, then they cordoned off our ranch, and then I come from a small town. Everyone knows everybody. I mean everybody from the...
Where are you from, Marcus?
A little town in East Texas.
East Texas. What's the name
of
it?
Yes, ma'am. Huntsville.
Huntsville, Texas. Okay, I've been through there.
So, it shuts down, and everybody's, comes out and starts, people start cooking, people start, cleaning and doing whatever. And it lasted for a while. I mean, upwards of 300 people, I guess.
Well,
that's not the whole town, but,
they were there at the house.
Yes, sir.
People were sending
on the
food.
Ground, sleeping in horse trailers and cooking on the bar, whole nine yards.
That's what you do in the South. They start cooking when there's a problem.
That's it. There's a problem.
No drinking beer, right? No drinking beer.
Everybody is there to help. Clean the house, do whatever.
There's no beer drinking going on.
Okay, now we know you're not telling the truth. So your mom thinks you're dead, and your dad, your brother never did, though, right? Your brother always believed, he felt you were still alive. And is that 7-minute difference thing, that twins sometimes have, you think?
Yes, sir. That's it.
So now
my butt in a jam a couple of times, and he was just like, he called up or something would happen. I mean, it's too long of a story to get into, but he knew, they knew.
Yeah, I got a sister like that. We're not twins, but we're 14 months apart, and I know when something's wrong, and she knows when something's wrong. It's kind of funny, isn't it?
It is.
So. Talk about what happens now. You're in this village. You're getting healthier, and what happens now with the crowd? What happens in terms of the army or the army did find you, right? Some Rangers came and got you. You had sent out a flare of some sort.
Well, no, I didn't send a flare out, sir. But right, the army and the Rangers and the ODA came in and got me. So they're the ones that found me.
So the Rangers find you, and I just can't imagine. You describe a bit. Did you speak to your mom when, how shortly after you were found and your family that were you able to actually?
Oh, it was a while. It was a while. I mean, once the Green Berets and the Rangers found me, and we were there for a while. They found me around noon, and I didn't get out of there until midnight. And then I was in the, I went straight to the hospital. So about 3-4 o'clock in the morning is finally when I think when I got to call home.
Wow, I bet your mom was real glad to hear you.
You know what? I don't really remember.
You don't. Remember.
I was, you know, I was so busted. They hit me with drugs as soon as I got on. As soon as I got on the aircraft, because I was in so much pain. You know, I had a lot of broken stuff, and anyways, that's a long story in itself. But this guy handed me this phone. He was just like, "Hey, here's your family." So I vaguely remember sitting there, and so I was like, "Hello," and it was my. It was one of both my brothers were standing there, and one of them was just like, you know, "Hey, what's going on?" I was just like, "Hey, what's going on?"
"What's going on?" I just pulled
the phone. And then you could hear, I mean, you could hear the screams. I could hear them in Afghanistan from Texas, and I'm not talking about over the phone. It was so loud.
Oh.
You know, one of them kind of things. And I was like, "Y'all all right?" And they were like, "Yeah, how are you?" And I was like, "Well," I was like, "it got me pretty good." And this is what they told me. And then I was like, "Well, okay, then I'm going to go because I'm stoned and I don't know what I'm talking about." You know,
how long were you in the hospital, Marcus?
Well, I was for a while.
Where were you, in Germany? Or
I started in Bagram, and then I went to Germany, and then from Germany I went to Hawaii. From Hawaii I went to San Diego.
Well, I have a friend who is a captain in San Diego of the Corps, so he's probably helped take care of you.
So George Bush calls you, right, number one, and that you were very excited to hear from George Bush one.
Yes, sir. That's actually a funny story because they were like, "All right, you're." They were like, "Okay, he had to plan it all out. And he's going to call." Well, my mom had my lunch ready for me because I was still busted up real bad. I had to sleep a lot, so she had to wake me up to come in there. And he was late calling me, so my mom was like, "Well, I don't care who it is. I got to feed my baby." Blah blah. So she moved me out of there. That's pretty funny. So I had just. You know, it took forever for me to sit down, and once I sat down, for me to get up and move around. So, and then he calls, and I'm in there eating. And my mom's like, "Well, he's eating right now. I'll talk to you."
That sounds like a Southern mom. I'm taking care of my baby.
Oh, it was, yeah. Well, he's busy eating right now. He needs his food.
And he's from the South, too. He understands.
Oh, he didn't have a problem with that whatsoever. Yeah, they talked for a little while, and then finally I hobbled in there, and I talked to him for a little while. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, wow.
And then of course you met with President Bush and that was obviously a big honor. And as you indicate in the book, and which is true, it's an honor for him and for you, right? I mean, you are a true American hero. And I'm just pleased that you took the time, and I know you were laid up in the hospital, to tell the story because it is an inspirational story and one which really needs to get out because I think it just helped a lot of people. And how they think about themselves in life and when they're confronted with challenges. And this show that this is on Blog Talk Radio, is called Now is the Time. And it's called Now is the Time because that's Marla and I live our lives that now is the time. And you obviously live your life where now is the time. You know,
he can also do anything for a few minutes at a time. And that's his training, and he did that going down that mountain, and it was just, he could do anything for 15 minutes, and that's what I preach, Marcus, is to teach people to do it now and take this opportunity, and we just appreciate you for all that you've done for us. This is probably the greatest interview I've ever done, Marcus, so. And I'm not good at interviewing people, but if I get to have a television show, you're the first person I'm going to have on.
Marla is getting her own TV show, you'll be on the list, Marcus, hopefully. So, Marcus, thank you very much for joining us.
Yes, sir.
On this show. It was great, and again, I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and once again, it's an honor for you to be with here.
I got one more question.
Okay, get it in.
Okay.
Sure.
What are you doing now, Marcus? Are you still in the military?
Oh, no, ma'am. I actually got out of the hospital, and I went back to Iraq for 7 months. I just got back not too long ago, and then I got discharged from the military because my injuries are kind of debilitating, and just couldn't do the job anymore. So now I live out on a ranch in Texas and do the physical therapy thing and try and stay out of trouble. And I'm kidding, that part's pretty easy now. I'm holding out now.
Once again, Marcus, thank you for taking the time out of your schedule to meet with us. Once again, Marcus Luttrell, the book is Lone Survivor. It's excellent. I encourage all of you to go out and pick it up on Amazon or wherever books are sold.
There's 640 reviews on Amazon for the book, Marcus, and we love you. Thanks for being on the show with us.
Thank you, Marcus.
Yes, ma'am. Y'all take care. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.